Hi, this is Jay. Last name is Gunkelman. I don't usually go by it. And you're listening to me on NeuroNoodle Network Podcast.
Thank you all for joining NeuroNoodle's Neurofeedback and Neuropsychology Podcast, featuring our neuropsychologists, Dr. Laura Janssens and Dr. Skip Wrenn. They've been practicing for well over 50 years and are happy to share their knowledge with you. You can find Dr. Laura at Janssens.com, that's J-A-N-S-O-N-S.com, and Dr. Skip can be found at DrSkipWrenn.com, DrSkipHRIN.com. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, it really helps get the word out. My name is Pete, and today we're going to chat with J.G. But before we get to J.G., we had a couple listener questions. Figured we'd address it now. This is from listener Ben P. I would love to learn more about the methods of transcranial stimulation or AlphaStim or Len Oakes Systemson method that involves actually running current into your body.
Transcranial direct current stimulation is different than Len Oakes's lens system. Okay. Transcranial DC stimulation is a really quite reliable method of altering the cortical excitability. If you put the plus electrode over an area, you actually can excite the cortex in the area by increasing electronegativity at the basal membrane. And if you put the minus electrode on top, you inhibit the area's function by increasing electropositivity at the basal membrane. And there's times that you only put one of those on the head and the other one goes on the shoulder. Sometimes you've got a spot in the brain you want to excite and another one you want to inhibit, and then both can go on the head. But that's not as common as one might think. It's quite common that overactivation is the problem and you have to put the reference on the shoulder.
Wow. These are very milliamps, right?
Most people overdo the intensity. If you start out at 0.5 milliamps, most people can't quite feel it. If you step it up to 1, people can kind of feel it usually. If you step it up beyond that, people feel a tingle or a buzzy electrical feeling.
If you feel that extent
of it, you're actually having skin effects. You've got it way too intense. If you've got it to the point where they can almost sort of tell that there's something on, that's perfect.
Right.
If they're getting a buzz or a tingle, you've got it too much.
Right, and you're trying to affect the chemical transfer between the cells at the ligand level?
Actually, the polarization within the basal membrane is what you're altering. Now, there's neurochemistry that goes along with that, but your direct effect is on the electrical polarization within the basal membrane. And that sets the level of activation for all of the neural networks that are in that area. So exciting the brain in an area sometimes can inhibit a function. If you're exciting an inhibitory area like the frontal lobe. So ultimately, you're talking about brain function, but if you're looking at the behavioral function that's associated with it, you can activate inhibitory areas and actually get less of something. If you understand what the function is at the location that you're stimulating, you have a pretty good idea of what the outcome of it is going to be. The effects are pretty reliable.
Right. So I understand that the gentleman who had the question, he was asking, he's got some symptoms of OCD. So we don't want to tighten the frontal lobe. We want to loosen it, right?
In fact, for OCD, you have a disturbance of the anterior cingulate. The cingulate's function is to give you cognitive and emotional flexibility. When it's disturbed, you can be locked onto something like OCD or ODD, or locked off like amotivation, lack of initiation, and ultimately akinetic mutism. The cingulate can have a failure of beta, which is still a failure, or alpha, or theta. If it's an alpha pattern at the anterior cingulate, you're highly likely, 85% probability of a positive response to an SSRI or SNRI. Now, look to the literature anywhere and find that kind of a percent effectiveness for that drug. You won't find it. That's the highest percent outcome report. It's essentially a lock and key biomarker. The research on that was Leslie Pritchup and Roy John out of NYU that did a cluster analysis of OCD. There's only one kind of OCD in the DSM. They asked the cluster analysis to find two. It found the alpha pattern, again, 85 plus percent positive response to SSRI, and the slow pattern, which is a theta pattern, but sometimes slips into the delta band. It's a rhythmic slow wave. And that has a 15% response to an SSRI or SNRI. And you get a 35% placebo response. So 15% is essentially a non-responding group. And we found the beta spindle pattern as well. And unlike the theta pattern, which just doesn't respond, but they don't have a bad response. It's just a lack of response. It's a waste of time and money to take the med, but at least you don't end up having a bad outcome. If you have a beta spindle pattern and you give an SSRI or SNRI, they basically have a negative side effect of overarousal. Quite often a panic attack or a meltdown of some sort.
Lennox system?
Sure. Lennox has a system that uses an extremely weak signal. So weak that the FDA basically said, it's so weak, you can't really have an effect, so go ahead and sell it. You know, yeah, it's like, well, you can't do anything bad with this because you can't do anything at all with it, so go ahead and sell it. The thing is, they're looking at it in the wrong way. If you're looking to have an effect on the brain and you're waiting to create an action potential with your stimulus, you're going to have a very strong stimulus, like a TMS pulse. That creates an action potential. I can make you wiggle your fingers, you know, and or wiggle your toes. But if you're dealing with a Lennox level system strength or pulse DMF, you know, there are other weak signals that were permitted by the FDA. It's a different approach. Let's say we create a bell, a gigantic bell, and it's got a big clanger. The clanger can whack the bell and it's like create an action. It will ring the bell. And the other way is I can have a little tiny padded mallet. And if I whap the bell, it doesn't really make any sound. But if I tap the bell at the right frequency, the bell will eventually ring. And a very weak signal with proper timing can influence a network. And you can't necessarily expect it to generate an action potential, but you can potentiate function with it. And again, it has to be timed properly to end up activating a network.
So the second part of Ben's question was, we addressed the OCD. He says, I'd really like to hear how neurofeedback helps people or case studies deal with and work through emotional-based problems. Can neuro help someone develop capacity for emotional connection, for example?
Okay. Emotional connectivity basically has a few underlying networks within the brain. The mirror neuron system is basically able to have, if you see something in the outside world that you relate to, you mimic or mirror it. And if you're mirroring affect, you end up learning affect. So the mirror neuron system has to work for you to end up developing empathy and social connections. Now, the mirror neuron on the left develops language. Ma, 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 pa, 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 da, da, da. You know, you mimic your mom or your dad as they're making the sounds. And eventually you realize, oh, ma, ma, and pa, pa, da, da, those are different people. So the mimicking or mirroring is a frontocentral loop. And if it's turned off, you see mu in the EEG. If that neural system is turned off, it has an idling rhythm like alpha in the back from closing your eyes. So if you disconnect from the outside world, you see mu. In the autism population, 70% of them have mu. The normal population, 15% of them have mu. But in the normal population, you also have things like elite athletes that have a disproportionately large amount of mu. They have to disconnect from the outside world to get into their internal state. But for developing emotion, it's not ma, 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 pa, pa, pa on the left side. It's facial expressions and body language. As an infant, your parent your parent smiles, you smile, the mimicking or mirroring happens, and you eventually comprehend emotion. That puts that information into the right posterior temporal parietal junction, like Wernicke area learned language on the left, the equivalent on the right. Now, I joke that Wernicke had a sister and she studied emotion, and we can stick the Wernicke name on the right hemisphere as well. It's just a joke. There isn't a sister. But I always joke about Wernicke's sister, you know. So Wernicke's sister area over on the right side is the spot that ends up perceiving facial expressions, body language, the emotional tone of speech. And that ends up allowing for social connections. For people that have PTSD, we see a gigantic change in that right temporoparietal junction. And depending upon the age at which the trauma occurred for PTSD, we could expect different frequency content as well. So it's something that's easily identifiable. When you see a giant alpha or a theta wave or a slow feature over there, you can predict that they've got social perceptual problems. So the brain has foundational networks to lay down the ability to socially connect with people.
And so it's interesting, putting the gentleman's case together. So he's asking about OCD, but he's also talking about social disconnection. So there's more than one thing kind of happening. But it does seem to kind of add up to something that looks like autism, right? So if he's got, over-controlled rigidity and poor social connection, there's PTSD, yeah, probably, as you're talking, or possibly,
yeah,
or maybe autism.
But what you have is a unique person, and what we have is the DSM, which is false categories. So if you take the DSM, burn it and flush the ashes down the toilet, I think you've treated it appropriately.
How do you really feel, Jay?
It's a false standard to which we're held. What's the EEG pattern of this diagnostic category? Well, if the diagnostic category was real, I could give you a pattern, but it's not. So I can give you a few patterns. I've been harnessed with the DSM as the standard we're compared to for all these years. And finally, when they declared that it wasn't valid, it was a reliable, highly reliable. You get the same diagnosis multiple times in a row with multiple different people doing the diagnostics. So it's a fabulous, reliable product, but it doesn't predict anything except your billing. So if you want it as an administrative tool, quit talking about clinical stuff with it. Just bill your patient the way you want to bill your patient, and then let the people that actually look at neurological and psychological function actually deal with the patient. The DSM is a false standard, and when they declared it invalid, I thought it was a sea change. Now, initially they said they were going to quit funding DSM research only, but the institutions pushed back really hard. If you were funded for the last 25 years at a university for studying XYZ disorder, whatever it might be, and then suddenly you had to do biological biomarkers and phenotypes and genotypes and stuff, and you're not oriented to that, your funding just disappeared. So there's a lot of institutional pushback that people cling to the DSM still, invalid as it is. It's a reliable thing for them to hang on to, and there's a lot of pushback. But ultimately, biomarkers, genotype, phenotype material is where things are moving.
And search domain criteria?
Yeah, exactly. 2015, as soon as they said they wanted research domain criteria studies, we cranked out one on beta spindles in the EEG. And not any DSM category, but just looking at all the people that had beta spindles, what was it associated with? The biggest correlation was insomnia. Beta spindles at CZ is a wakefulness drive. And if you have a wakefulness drive, you're going to have trouble falling asleep and staying asleep. And there's a good counterbalance to that. The sleep spindle is something that counters the wakefulness drive. If you don't have a well-developed sleep spindle, as you start to fall asleep, you get to stage two. Get a vertex sharp wave, which is the body's response to a stimulus, and then the sleep spindle keeps you stable, or you're going to wake up with it if you don't have a good sleep spindle. If you have beta spindles, they're not a sleep spindle. You're going to pop back awake on your way to sleep so you don't fall asleep well. And then during your sleep, you're going to pop up to stage two at some point and you're going to pop back awake. SMR, the sensory motor rhythm that Barry Sternman discovered all those years ago in cats, is exactly the same signal generator, frequencies, everything is a sleep spindle. Same thing, different state. SMR when you're awake, sleep spindle when you're asleep. Now, when you're asleep, the projection pathway has a little bit more option available to it. You can see it a little further front, but when you're awake, it's pretty well restricted to the sensory motor strip, which is obviously why Barry ended up calling it the sensory motor rhythm. There's a lot of confusion between mu and SMR in some people's mind, but they're totally different. You know, your sleep spindle is well developed when you're a year old. It doesn't need to mature up to speed like alpha does. And mu is related to alpha. It has to mature up to speed. Not at all the same rhythm, not at all the same locations or generators. And again, there's a lot of confusion between those two, and there really shouldn't be.
Well, Ben, we answered your questions, and oh man, Jay Gunkelman just comes in and knocks them out of the park. 1, 2, 3, bam. Jay, how did you first get exposed to neurofeedback?
You know,
you've got this long history.
I'm a spoiled kid of a well-to-do family, and I went to the University of North Dakota pre-med program, with advanced placement because of testing. They thought I was smart or something, you know. Tests, you know. Yeah, you can't believe a damn thing you see in a test. So 3 years pre-med, I was accepted in med school, but, you know, 1969, I didn't really think I wanted to be a doctor. So I told my dad, you know, Dad, I'm not going to go to medical school. And he said, oh, go to Europe, sow your wild oats. you'll come back with your head screwed on straight and you go to med school. So I said, well, let me get this straight. You're going to give me a credit card and I'm going to go to Europe for about a year and play around. And then I'll come back. Is that what you're proposing? Hey, hand me the credit card. I'll be gone in a flash. You know? So I goofed around in Europe for a long period of time. I saw the U.S. land on the moon from a small dance bar in the middle of a small town in Europe, in Germany. It was a fabulous year. Met some great friends in Europe. Came back and still didn't want to be a doctor. I switched schools to North Dakota State University from Grand Forks, UND, to NDSU in Fargo. I was interested in psychology and philosophy. And the psychology, with a medical school sort of a background, I thought physiological psych looked pretty interesting. And that was in the early days, just when biofeedback and neurofeedback wasn't a term then, it was EEG biofeedback still then. All that was kind of a brand new applied psychophysiology thing. And applied psychophysiology was interesting to me. My professor told people in the overly crowded classroom, as we were about to start a new semester, look to your left, look to your right. Tomorrow they won't be here. The first 2 weeks we're going to learn brain anatomy. I'll tell you two spots in the outside of a head, make an imaginary line, describe the structures and functions on the way through. And sure enough, there were only four of us after, about 40 people in the first overly crowded, only four of us were left. My lab partner at the state hospital, he and I wrote a grant together, were in that class. Physiological psych made great sense given the strong science background. And talking psychology, I wasn't that impressed with it, neuroanatomy, neurophysiology, feedback, all that made really great sense. We wrote a grant. I had not graduated. We wrote a grant. I had a lot of credits because I was just playing in school, taking any course I wanted to. And we wrote a grant and it was funded, probably more because of my family, a family name back in North Dakota. Gunkelman's as good as gold, you know. In California, they get G and it locks up about there. the last part of the name doesn't quite make it out sometimes. So they funded the lab, and we ran that lab for 3 years, and it was a fabulous background. Basically, imagine a kid with all of the toys that you wanted with no IRB. So, yeah, what do you want to do? Oh, I don't know. But we actually did sensory deprivation tank work with underwater speakers. So it was no longer sensory deprivation, but you could pump in pink noise on the speakers. And then as the person slipped from alpha into a theta dominant state, the pink noise fades out in a tape loop with their voice on it, with a new message for them fades in. This is brainwashing. We brainwashed people, no IRB, you know, and it was transactional analysis, which is a brand new kind of talking psychology at the time. You know, you have a I'm okay, you're okay. And if you're not okay, maybe there's some script that you've got that needs to be reprogrammed, meta programming and all that kind of crap. Well, we reprogrammed people 5 hours in the tank and people had a brand new message in their head. When we were developing the technology and everything to do that, I actually had a tank experience with my lab partner's voice on the tank. On the tape, I had his voice in my head for a couple of weeks. So it's really powerful. And there's no way to cognitively stop the programming, because if you alert and orient at all, it's gone. It's pink noise again. As soon as you fade out, it pumps in. As soon as you alert or orient, it goes away. So you can't consciously resist it. You know, quite effective. We didn't tell anybody about our outcomes. This was 1974, 75. Nixon was still president back in 74. So in fact, the lab was covered on the front page of the local paper, big pictures on the front page. Nixon was below the fold on his way out, you know, so.
So JG or Jay Gunkelman, Mary Tracy from Stens asked to have you on the show. What is your history with Mary and Stens? Just curious for all the Stens people out there.
Well, I've known Steve Stern since 1972 when he was the sales rep for Autogen equipment. I met him at the first Biofeedback Research Society that I went to in Monterey. And since then, he's obviously a good person in sales and management. And eventually he's got his own company and he does a very nice job promoting specific equipment. And he's got educational material that they present. They do a nice job with certification courses. Mary was more recently brought on as an instructor for him. Now, she goes back to the 60s and early 70s as a tech as well. She worked in the Navy. She worked in a sleep lab. I had a 3-bed sleep lab. So we had all this sleep lab crap together as, you know, commonality. Mm-hmm. And she had heard that I knew something about EEG, and she had some difficult cases she wanted to have looked at. And after 3 1-hour sessions reviewing raw EEG waveforms together and chatting a little bit about the old days, she asked if she could do a documentary about me. And I quite honestly thought it was like, yeah, she'd come in with a little handheld and ask 2 or 3 yeah. questions and that'd be it. But she shot 36 hours of video across 2 years. They edited it down to a 2-hour documentary. And I'm luckily they didn't edit it into me being the class clown any more than I am, you know. But it's apparently going over pretty well. I have trouble watching it myself, but oh well, you know.
What's the name of that? What's the name of that, Jack?
Signal in the Noise is the formal name, but everybody calls it the Gunklementary. I think the common name has probably eclipsed the formal name, but I think they're trying to market it as an educational thing, and there can be a lot of people that don't have any idea, you know, what I've done or who I am or anything. And at that point, the Signal in the Noise is an appropriate name for it. I had looked at over 500,000 EEGs by the early 1990s. And at that point, I started to actually think I saw something. You know, when you think you see something, your data is speaking to you. You've got two options. Well, first of all, you've got to publish what you think you see. Now, you're either totally crazy and you're seeing something in the data, or you might have actually seen something in the data that's meaningful. So you have to actually put it out there as a straw dog for people to rip up or validate. And it was a retrospective analysis. I mean, I'm looking in the rearview mirror at 500,000 studies I'd seen, and I said, oh, there's some common patterns. And I'm trying to come up with a list of these common patterns that predict a lot of variability, a minimum number of patterns that predict the maximum amount of variability. So I'm not trying to make more categories. I'm just trying to find the common patterns. I came up with 11 that I had seen so reliably that I thought they had to be, you know, kind of foundational EEG patterns. Well, looking at the list, I noticed that two of them had known genetic correlates, which meant they were phenotypes, endophenotypes. And I essentially wrote a paper along with my business partner and his girlfriend, who was a nurse who also helped out. And Joy Lunt is still alive. Jack passed a few years ago. I realized these are phenotypes. The others are, other nine are candidate phenotypes. And since then, they've been validated as well as having genetic correlates. Johnson & Johnson spent $4 million to do 100 people full genome workup quite a while ago now. Prices have come down. Their statistician thought it was a waste of time and money, because how can EEG patterns predict genetics? Well, they were shocked that they actually found meaningful correlates between these EEG patterns and genetics. Now, they didn't release all their information. Like many drug companies, they hold their research outcomes quite tightly and don't basically release that information. So they've identified the other nine with detail. Martijn Arns has found public domain correlates to some of the patterns as well. I used to travel when I still could. I can't anymore. Ever since the brain surgical patch failed, I leaked cerebrospinal fluid out my nose. I can't fly. And I'm not well enough to have surgical intervention. So I just leak, but I can't fly anymore. But when I used to fly I would go over to Europe, and Martijn had set up a lecture, and it's Amsterdam, fly in, hang out for a few days. It was a lot of fun. And then take the train to Nijmegen and do a lecture. Well, when I arrive in Nijmegen, he's got a stack of EEGs, 49 ADD, 49 match controls. I have to phenotype the ADD kids and the controls, and have to predict based on the phenotypes which kid is going to respond to stimulants, their ADD, ADHD kids. Well, it predicted accurately. They already knew who responded. I predicted accurately with the phenotype model who responded to stimulants. They then offered $5,000 to anybody who did a better job. Now, they didn't offer it to me, you know, and that's okay. Basically, only one group in the world tried. The vigilance modeling people in Europe tried, and they didn't beat ours. But, you know, Martijn had 3 minutes of EEG. No. The phenotype model requires 10 minutes of EEG for them to properly evaluate it. So me saying that we beat them is foolish, because we tied one arm behind their back and blindfolded them, and then I can beat them. You know, I mean, they didn't have an honest 10-minute shot at an assessment. So, you know, with the proper data set, they may be equivalent or better, who knows. But the we did effectively predict with the endophenotype model who would respond to the stimulants. And it took me about 2 hours to go through those 100 EEGs. I used to have 100 a day in the lab, so it wasn't that foreign to me. The next time I showed up a few months later for another lecture, he had 126 depressives, 126 matched controls. That took me the whole day. I mean, over 200 and something cases to analyze. And in the depressive work, that's when they pulled up the genetic testing on 100 of the depressives that they could find. So, and that was full blood draw. Anyway, we've stayed busy with the endophenotype model with little validations here and there across the years. And luckily it worked out. It was a retrospective paper. There were people who read it and, you know, it's published, so it must be real. Well, it's retrospective. You can't drive your car looking out the rearview mirror. If you do, you're going to run off a cliff somewhere probably. So I was really a little afraid when we published it that people would just run with it. And some people did. Luckily, it turned out well. I mean, it could have just as easily a retrospective paper. You know, it could have been just a nut looking and thinking he saw something, you know. So I'm really quite happy that I didn't have a whole bunch of lemmings going off a cliff.
I know you're going to hold back on your answer, Jay, but I'll ask you anyway. So, you know, what you just said there, you know, about the phenotypes and predicting medication efficacy, I mean, that's a pretty phenomenal observation. And so my question is, you know, we're neuropsychologists and neurofeedback practitioners here, and we have other clinicians who listen. We have other, you know, people who are interested in the field, and we also have patients and parents of children who come to see us, et cetera. So, you know, as I hear, you know, that bit of research that you just referenced, why isn't this information more mainstreamed? Why isn't neurofeedback more, you know, I'm in Chicago, Skip there is in Alaska, and he also is part-time in Florida. So, you know, we're kind of span the map here a little bit. What do you think is keeping this kind of information from the masses? Why don't we know more, and why aren't people using it?
Well, if you roll the clock back to the 1970s and you were standing around the early meetings, there were groups of people that were researchers from universities like Sturman. There were military people like Rich Sherman. The military was all over that stuff as well, CIA and military intelligence. And there were also hippies. And I have to apologize. I was the long-haired hippie in the meetings, and the field got a reputation as just a bunch of hippies. And that we were there, there's no question about it, but we also were putting out some pretty interesting work. My first laboratory in 1972 was the first state hospital laboratory in the world. I ran that for 3 years before I moved to California to manufacture equipment, and realized fairly quickly that selling equipment into a niche market is a good way to go broke. So I ended up getting a job in an EEG lab. Had to cut my hair at that point.
It's wrong about that.
But, you know, the reputation of the field as a bunch of hippies did happen. But there was a bad piece of research that ended government funding. Pashkowitz and Orn looked at alpha training. And if you, you know, think back to early 70s, it was alpha training or SMR. Those were the two things you could do. And they did alpha training. And they tried to correlate it with emotion. Now, they trained alpha at the back of the head in the visual area, not exactly an emotion-rich territory, really. And they trained it with an ineffective training technique. They trained it on and off and on and off and on and off. And to get alpha going, you pretty much have to let it roll for a while. Jim Hart found extended sessions to be extremely useful to get into the alpha state deeply. So they showed no learning curve, and then they concluded that alpha training didn't have anything to do with emotion, and the whole field basically lost government funding. About the time I built a pocket-sized brainwave analyzer, which we couldn't sell any of them. I mean, that's why I went into the EEG lab, because selling equipment was a waste of time. The field in the U.S. kind of ground to a halt almost. Sturman had Lubar in his lab. There were a few people that kind of spun off of Kamiya or Lubar's stuff, but it was very rudimentary, not well established in academia. And luckily sputtered along through the late 70s, early 80s to the late 80s, and started to pick up effective outcomes clinically, drove the field's funding. Basically, no government funding, just out-of-pocket funding. If you look at it now, it's actually internationally doing extremely well. In the United States, if you ask physicians who aren't familiar with it, they'll still give you, it's a bunch of hippies. And again, I have to apologize for that. But, internationally, major academic institutions do neurofeedback research and studies. Salzburg, Austria, Klemisch's lab, the Consciousness and Sleep Lab, have done validation studies on SMR and insomnia. Graz, Austria, Gert Furcheller's lab has replicated that. You go to South Korea, the government there funded a 10-year project to come up with a normative database, not just of EEG and ERPs, but also genetics and diet and everything. The international field, if you're standing in the United States, you don't see the active development of the field internationally. But you can go to international universities and be a respected researcher doing neurofeedback research. Until very recently, you could kill your career by asking to do a neurofeedback research project. So, we're escaping the stereotypical "it's a bunch of hippies" thing slowly because of international success.
Is there anything we can do to? I guess that's our point here, why we have the podcast, is to get it more people friendly. Anything that you would suggest people we could do as a field to?
It's entering academic teaching at this point. But let's say today, all the academics started to teach neurofeedback at a high level and students could come out of the university with that knowledge. Well, how long is it going to take to penetrate practice? Well, you come out as a junior partner somewhere. You can't do anything unless it's in the protocol that's developed in the practice, and you can't bring in anything new until you're established. So it'd be 5 to 10 years before it would actually hit the streets in a major way. I've been in the field almost 50 years now, and you think about it, I've had this nasty headwind the entire time, but I don't mind. I mean, I'm bullheaded enough. I grew up in Fargo. If you want something done, you just do it yourself. There's nobody else to do it. I've been perseverative in this area for a long, long time. I find really solid neuroscience here. I've got really high level friends that are neurosurgeons and neurologists and epileptologists, and we don't have any difficulty talking about neurofeedback and brain function and neuroanatomy and neurophysiology stuff. I mean, I, I think it's extremely well accepted at a scientific level at high levels at this point. It's going to take time to penetrate down to, you know, Earth from high level academics down to, you know, not everybody teaching at a university is at the high level of neurofeedback. So it's going to take a long time.
That's okay.
Hey, what about insurance? When is insurance going to start paying its way?
Insurance's business is to deny coverage. Until we get away from the insurance market, they'll always be an anchor that's dragging behind the boat. You know, I'm self-insured still. Imagine a brain tumor. Who's going to insure you after you've had a brain tumor? You know, and my medications are extremely expensive, but you know that none of them are on the formulary for Medicare. I haven't even opted in on Medicare. I have a POLST EMT DNR on myself, a physician order for life sustaining technology, emergency medical tech, do not resuscitate. You know, the medic alert here, yeah. They see that, they go to your wallet and they see a big red page telling them to leave you the hell alone. So I'm fine with the outcome, no matter what way it goes, whenever it happens. And I have near-death experiences commonly for the last 28 years. I have a near-death experience rate. And the Grim Reaper and I are old friends. I see him, I wave over here, you know. I'm not in the insurance market, and I don't think that they're our friends, and I don't think that their intention is to cover anything new. They'll fight tooth and nail the entire way. In Washington State, the parents of autistics sued for parity, the equivalent treatment in medicine, and they won. But you know, you think you win, it's a battle. The war of insurance is still ongoing. So the insurance companies basically said, okay, if we have to spend $500,000 a year on treatment for autistic kids, you have to get your kid diagnosed at a center of excellence. Your family doctor can't be the one to say you're autistic. And you know, I can understand to a certain extent why they were a little concerned, because there are a lot of genetic disorders that are kind of lumped in with autism, and they're probably a slightly different entity. But autism is also a cluster of different entities. It's not a single unitary thing. It's a DSM cluster. And the DSM itself is a cluster or something, you know. So I'm happy to see people break down these categories into smaller subsets. But I don't expect insurance to be jumping to the front and saying, oh, please here, take our money. They'll resist that as long as they can.
I've seen some things that you've done on YouTube, you know, different talks that you've had on gamma, and you just mentioned NDEs. And so I know gamma at levels is correlated with consciousness and all kinds of interesting things. So certainly if you want, you know, lay the groundwork for that. But my question more is, recently it seems like MIT is looking at gamma treatments for things like Alzheimer's. And so I'm wondering how that connection works. And I know that's kind of a giant blanket of a question.
Well, consciousness is an interesting topic, and we can predict conscious, unconscious based on the EEG really reliably. In fact, there's an FDA registered device called the bispectral index, the BIS index, that they use for same day surgeries. And what they're looking at, their secret formula inside their little box, is they're correlating 0.38 hertz, which is infra low frequency generated by glia, and 38 hertz, gamma generated by neural networks. When glia and neural networks interact, you're conscious. Consciousness is an interaction between glia and neural networks. If you don't have glia interacting with neural networks, you are not conscious. Anything that alters consciousness alters either gamma or infralow frequency or both. So psilocybin, ayahuasca, salvia divinorum, all of these things that alter consciousness, you can actually predict when you look at the EEG whether the consciousness is altered or not at that point. That simple relationship ends up being foundational. It's unfortunate that there aren't a lot more people that understand how the brain works and how consciousness works, but there's a neurophysiological solid underpinning for consciousness and altered consciousness. I'm working right now on a big DMT project. Royal College of Medicine, Entheon, and Divergence group, which is two Canadian companies in the Royal College of Medicine, and trying to predict by looking ahead of time who's ready for a trip and who's not, and things like that. So we're just getting into the EEG data. I'm just starting to flip through the records, and it's important what phenotype you have as to what response you're going to have to a particular medication or a particular neurofeedback protocol or other interventions. So it's your base state, who are you now? And that can change what you respond to. So I'm happy to see consciousness researchers at this point. I was sorry to see Walter Freeman finally pass. He was a sweetie, and he really knew deeply. Pretty much the lead scientist for nonlinear analysis of brain activity, and old friend.
So with the gamma, how is that being used in relation to the Alzheimer's? Is it getting after glia, microglia functioning?
There are people that use via light gamma frequency content, and that's essentially stimulating the brain with light. And the frequency that they're stimulating is in the gamma range. Now, there's some interesting reports on improved cognitive function or sustained cognitive function. But this is still very early. I think we've got a long way to go before that's an accepted treatment. One of the things that they've noticed is that though people can maintain their cognitive function while they're receiving stimulation, when they stop, there's a precipitous decline. Well, having a therapy associated with a precipitous decline is not a good matchup either. And they have to start to figure out what's going on with that too. Photobiomodulation is an interesting area. The Koreans have put out a helmet that has dry sensor electrodes in it. And the helmet expands and contracts to the size of the head, and the electrodes move proportionately, so they maintain a 10-20 system proper location. They have a photobiomodulation in the center of each of the electrodes. So the things are moving along on the ability to do photobiomodulation based on the EEG. That helmet, by the way, hooks up with a cell phone, which goes to the internet, and they've got a cloud server AI that can end up essentially predicting where to stimulate. It's an interesting group. They have a discriminant, an AI-based discriminant that tells you when you first present with mild cognitive impairment complaints, doc, my memory's not quite right, do I have Alzheimer's? They've got a better than 90% accuracy identifying whether you're normal aging with some cognitive changes or whether you're likely Alzheimer's. They also have the ability to differentiate. They're just implementing this one, Alzheimer's from other forms of dementia like Parkinsonism and where Lewy body.
I kind of want to get into your background with the Biofeedback Society of California. You were president of it twice.
Yeah.
Can you just go a little bit into your background there and how does that contrast with the BCIA for the newbies out there? Yeah.
Sure. BCIA is a certifying body and there are membership organizations. BCIA, you can't be a member of BCIA. You don't want to have a membership organization handing out certificates. It's like, are you a member? Okay, we'll give you a certificate. You know, so they're a certifying body. They have testing, and if you qualify and you pass the tests and you keep up your CEs, you can have a certificate that you're qualified. Basically, it's a base level qualification. It's not the test doesn't. It's not an impossible test. But it's a good base level to show that you've done your due diligence of didactic learning and coursework and hands-on equipment and so forth. So BCAA is a great certifying body. I support them fully. Membership organizations include ISNR. I was president there. AAPB, I was treasurer at AAPB for a few years. And it also includes state and local regional organizations, Northeast Regional, Mid-Atlantic, Florida has one, Texas has one, the Upper Midwest has one. California went from California Biofeedback Society to the Western Society. But little societies are really hard to maintain. It's got to have somebody running it, and there's no money to run it, you know? So, they're notoriously on the edge of failing on an ongoing basis. I've seen them almost failing for over 40 years. So they sputter along and somebody has to step up and grab the reins and, you know, run it for a while. And my last time I was elected president, I have diabetes insipidus because of no pituitary. So I had to get out and pee. So I left the room. I came back. They elected me president and adjourned the meeting. So you don't want to turn your back on those kind of groups. You know, all the societies end up kind of moving along. They have a parent umbrella underneath AAPB or ISNR assisting. But the local regional groups are borderline organizations. Now, they put on really good meetings. The California Society had national quality meetings, but no budget. So it was always, did we make enough money at the meeting to be able to put down a down payment on a hotel for next year, you know? So it was always marginal. I always auction off my beard. And I auctioned off my beard to the California Society for $2,000 at one point as a fundraiser. Over the years, I've raised $17,000 getting shaved. What kind of group is this anyway, you know? We had a professor from UCLA at one of the meetings and they did a shave at that meeting. And he said, you know, I'll never forget this meeting. I've never been to a scientific meeting where they shaved somebody before, you know. I've done it in Australia for $5,000 for their student fund. It was 4,000 Australia, 5,000 US. As I say, total of 17 over the years. But that's how borderline they are. I mean, if somebody asks to offer their beard to get shaved to fund something, you know, the things are borderline, you know?
So Jay,
it's low overhead.
Who's got dibs on your locks now?
you know, it's got to be a face-to-face meeting. Nobody will pay to have it cut at a, you know, somebody else cut it off. And
you just put it in an envelope and send it to us. That's
you know, the Australian shave, I thought that was it. But the next year they had taken it and glued it on a wig head. You know, the wigs that they measure electrodes on, they glued it onto a wig head. Imagine this ratty shit on a wig head, you know, and they sold that for $500, you know, so I couldn't believe it. You know, if I saw that, I'd go for the fumigator, you know. it was looking pretty ratty on the wig head.
Did you ever do any work with the Monroe Institute, either with NDEs or consciousness or any of that over the years?
Not anything direct with them. However, I'm quite familiar with their work. The Society for Scientific Exploration was hosted in Virginia at their campus, and they had a tour of their institute. My talk there was on consciousness. So the neurophysiological basis of consciousness, and it went over very well.
I would keep that up.
The near-death experience, healers, all that kind of stuff. I've worked in that area as well. At the meeting, SSE meeting, I had a healer approach me. And another person who wanted to study the healer, and they asked me if I was interested in studying the EEG of a healer. And I said, if there's evidence of him healing something, sure. If it's got a brain in it, I'd be happy to look at it. I just want to know that there's actually evidence of him having healed something. So, and he had been studying at Pear Institute, you know, and there, he was valid, Bill Bankston. And a fellow in Minnesota wanted to do the research. And I said, okay, if we're going to do it, we're going to have to do it right. I'm going to order a couple of amplifiers in from Russia that have a 150 hertz high end, because we don't know what frequencies might be involved in this. It could be gamma 2, and everybody's amp here in the US kind of stops at, you know, 50, 60, 70 hertz. And, you know, you might want to look at 80 to 100 or ripples faster than 100. So we ordered special amps. They set it up in our office in the Phoenix area. And the healer in one room and the Healy down the hall in a side room. We had two EEG techs do the hookups. I didn't do any EEG hookups. I just monitored the experiment. And we basically identified the Schumann resonances as a feature that happens when healing was the intention of healing was happening. We published that in the Journal of Scientific Exploration. It was very difficult to get it published because it's an engineering journal and they don't understand EEG very well. So it took a while to get them to understand how we got frequency resolution, reporting frequency resolution without 100 and something seconds worth of data to come up with a, you know, 0.01 hertz kind of thing. So anyway, at one point I told them, I'm sorry, you guys are too stupid to publish this. I'll publish it somewhere else. And they said, oh, no. They brought in an expert finally and said, no, they're right. That's how you do it. And so they published it. I was asked by a group that was going to do a healing. 10,000 people worldwide at a certain time were going to do a healing intention. And this guy is on stage at a hotel, and they wanted to do an experiment, and they did a 5-minute baseline and 2 5-minute periods, and one of the 5-minute periods had healing in it. And they asked me to look at the data blinded, and I didn't close the other eye, but you know, I didn't know anything about what period was what. And I simply looked for the Schumann resonances in a bispectral display, and you know, one of the 5-minute periods was full of the resonance and one wasn't. I said, this is the period that they did the healing. And they said, oh my God, this is fabulous. I said, well, don't ever show anybody this data, because it's 50-50. I could have flipped the coin and got the odds of picking the right one, you know? So next time you do it, have a baseline period and 9 periods during which it could be done, and pick 2 of them randomly at the time that you're doing it, so that people elsewhere like me and whoever's doing the recordings and stuff don't really know what period anything happened in. And we spotted it accurately then too, you know. So, you know, 2 out of 9, you know, now you're starting to make the unbelievers start to scratch the head a little bit, at least. So, but a 50-50 chance, nobody's gonna, you know, go, oh my goodness, on that. So, the Monroe Institute did all sorts of interesting binaural beats and, a lot of psychotech stuff that was really interesting. I never worked directly with him, no.
Okay. I want to thank Jay Gunkelman, Chief Science Officer at Brain
like
Science
Spock.
Internet.
Just like Spock.
Just like Spock, got it. Jay, you can be found at Brain Science International or QEEG Support. I know you don't want any new business, but somebody wants to look you up, where do we send them?
If you go to QEEGsupport.com, they'll see all sorts of details, scientific support for people doing QEG and neurofeedback. And that it doesn't have any real route to get to me, but you get all, right. Lots and lots of good data. If somebody absolutely has to get a hold of me, they'll find me online, you know. Brain Science International does have a website and email and all of that. But if you contact the company, I'll guarantee you won't get to me through the company. Anybody who refers a call straight through to me would be fired on the spot. So,
remind me not to call.
So, thanks for the invite. It's been
you.
Fun.
Yeah, thanks,
as you could tell, I'm a devout hedonist, and I always find fun in life. So.
And Dr. Laura can be found at Janssons.com. That's JANSONS.com. Dr. Skip can be found at drskiphrin.com. Ideas for a topic, please email me, pete@neuronoodle.com. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Smash that like button on Facebook, Instagram, and please follow us on Twitter. Thank you again, Jay. Cue the music.
Thanks,
what
Jay.
What a great show. Thank you. He said, we got to have you on. I'm like, all right, Mary. Because I asked for her to come on and Mary Tracy. And then she says, well, you got to get Jay on. I'm like, okay.
Well, she started going over some EEGs with me quite a long time ago now. And after the third session together, she's an old tech too. And we started to talk about the old days and how far things have come and how things have changed. And, you know, I'm kind of reading the person's psychological presentation from the EEG, which is not anything that anybody who's done EEG historically thought was possible even. And my sessions with her, I get the EEG with no history. Give me a second here. My dog wants to get on my lap here.
Oh, nice pup.
75 pounds of lap dog here.
Oh,
yeah. He's a oversized Vizsla. He's 12 years old and he's spoiled. So he's got a few extra pounds.
Totally understand.
So, but so do I. So, you know, what the hell? So. As she saw what was possible, she decided to do the video documentary, and she asked me if I'd sit for the documentary, and I sure I'll sit for you to, you know, do some. I thought she'd come in with a little handheld video camera and ask a couple questions and that'd be it, you know. But yeah. It took two years, 35, 36 hours of videos. You know, they had an entire crew that took over the house, people with their clapboards to, you know, take one, take two, all that kind of stuff. So I was kind of blown away by the end product. I didn't see the end product until it was actually shown. And I didn't know whether they were going to paint me as the class clown or the protagonist or how it was going to be edited up. You know, you can edit video into almost anything. So I was pleased that I wasn't just, you know, pilloried or something.
No, you're a popular guy. Mary speaks highly.
Yeah.
Okay, my sister, Dr. Laura Jansen, is on here.
How's it going? I love your eye patch.
It's a Morlet wavelet, which is a cosine tapered sine wave.
Very cool.
When I asked the artist who does eye patches, had a different price for complex versus simple designs. And so I called her and she said, well, what do you want on the eye patch? I said, a Morlet wavelet. And she said, what's that? I said, check it out on Google. You know, I'm going to describe it as a cosine tapered sine wave. What the hell does that mean to anybody? You know? So anyway, I'm sure she thought she'd do one of them, you know, but for the documentary donations for the fundraising, Mary had a couple dozen of these things made, some in red. So apparently some of the women wanted it in red, and one for the other eye for somebody that actually had a problem with the right eye that would have been left, you know. So anyway,
right.
She cranked out a whole pile of these.
So Jay, since you're accustomed to fancy productions, I'm sure the script that I sent you is nothing for you.
I don't even remember seeing a script, but
okay, all right.
I'm not easily scripted usually.
Oh
so.
Yeah. Well, that's the beauty of editing. Hi, this is Jay Gunkelman, CEO of. And then whatever you want, however you want to address yourself. Okay. I got it wrong on the,
I'm a retired chief science officer, and I'm still the chief science officer, but I'm retired from my active duties in the company. Okay. Brain Science International,
here in
California.
Okay.
I've had a number of companies over the years. I shed them kind of like a snake has skin, you know? So
Yeah.
But that was lasted quite a long time. I think maybe 15 years or something. So, okay. It was quite successful. We still are going, processing kind of high end. We're not cheap. So there are a lot of people go elsewhere, for the price, and that's fine with me. Quite honestly, if I look around at all the people providing EEG, QEG analysis services, they were customers of mine at one point, you know? So, and that's fine. I don't want to have people dependent on us. I want people to grow and become independent. So I'm happy to see it.
Teach them how
especially
to fish.
Since I'm retired, you know, I mean, I would hate for the field to hit a wall when I retired, you know, so.
We're going to try and pick up the baton, Jay. Okay. Jay, Dr. Skip Wren hopped on. Skip, hey, say hi to Jay.
Hey, Jay, good morning.
Love the knotty pine.
That's a requirement to have that, right? That pine.
Here, I'm staying in a cabin because our house, whatever, somebody's in it. But check out what it's got in it. I don't know if you guys can see.
Yeah.
Great.
Bunch of.
Fabulous.
You know,
look at that guy. That's the second minx I've seen. The last one I saw was walking around.
Yeah, don't turn the lights out there, man.
Okay, Jay. Now you're loose. I can tell you're loosened up.
You know me.
I'm trying to get to know you.
I've been a loose cannon all my life. So you want me to introduce myself? This is Jay. You're listening to NeuroNoodle Podcast.
Well, I don't know how many J's there are in the world. Maybe you want to kind of.
I usually go by Jay. I skip the last name best I can.
Okay, fine. Well, you are a pretty famous guy, so.
There's too many people that have stuck their name on things like Wernicke's area in the brain and stuff like that.
All right.
But what about J-Lo? One of my pet peeves.
I didn't quite hear.
What about J-Lo?
Yeah.
J-Lo, there you go. Well, yeah. But I've been called worse, too. So.
All right. JG. Well, today's a historic day for the podcast, at least from what I can see. First day of Google. First page neurofeedback podcast, and two out of the three recommended podcasts are ours, guys. So golf clap.
Hey, made the big page. Big page.
Big page. Okay. If Steve Stern can do this, you can do this, Jay.
Yeah.
You know Steve?
I know Steve. Okay. I met him in 1972
when we first started
Biofeedback Research Society meeting. He was a salesperson for Autogen Equipment at the time. So
it's hard to talk to that guy without taking out your credit card, isn't it?
Well, that's if you're head of sales in 1972 and you're still in the business all these years later,
you gotta be pretty good
at selling something, you know. So
is that your MRI in the blanket behind you?
Those are MRIs. It's a very nice quilt that was made for me. It's got neurological stuff on both sides. Cool. This is, I think, actually kind of intended as the back side of it. The other side has all the little patches put together and stuff. But
need to mark it close.
Yeah, and I can't imagine where you find all the material. You know, the chemical structure of serotonin, all the letters of the Greek alphabet for the EEG. You know, where do you find these things? You know, so.